Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 32 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A session with Cinten's employment team. As you usually say at this point, thank you so much once again for all your positive comments about these sessions, for continuing to sign up to them, for tuning in each week, for sending in your questions, which we are really grateful for, and for watching the video online afterwards and listening to the podcast. So thank you for that. As with previous months, just moving these slides, the employment team are going to answer three questions, and our speakers today are there in front of you, partner and head of department Keith Land and associate Angela Carver. Our questions are in front of you for today, so Angela is going to go first. Angela, good morning, and over to you.
Hi, David. Good morning, and thank you to everybody for joining us this morning. We've just been having a pre-Q&A chat about how old Cliff Richard is. So if you want to know, David will share that information with you at the end of the Q&A. The first question I'm going to address is whether or not you pay a bonus to somebody if they are on sick leave. So the starting point with a bonus would always be the contract of employment. So if the contract explicitly states what happens with a bonus, that's great. That would be the end of this question. But usually the term, which is highly subjective, discretionary, is often used in contracts. So some bonus schemes are discretionary in all respects. So whether or not the bonus is paid at all, and if so, how much and how it's calculated. In other cases, there may be a contractual element to the bonus, for example, to be considered for a discretionary bonus, but no actual right to receive a bonus. Also, quite unhelpfully, a bonus might start off as a discretionary bonus, but it might then become contractual over time. So, for example, an employer may make regular payments of a certain amount or calculated in the exact same manner over a number of years, and this could actually be a bonus which is implied into an employee's contract of employment. Clearly, if this is the case, you do need to take further advice, and it's not just a black or white question, it is quite grey. So what do we do if someone's off sick? Well, your first choice will always be just to pay the individual. So whether or not the individual is on short or long-term sickness absence, if you pay them, that nips any risk in the bud, is where we are for that person. But then you've also got to remember that your employees will talk about pay, and they will talk about salary, and they will talk about benefits, even if something is supposed to be confidential. So you have to think about, if you are going to pay this bonus to somebody who's on short or long-term sick, how will that affect the morale for those who are rarely or never absent from the business? And it's about noting that resentment can actually be a powerful player in undermining team harmony, and also how this fits in with your ethos of fairness within the business, especially if there's been a minimal contribution to the performance or the achievement of any bonus. So from my perspective, a pro rata bonus would be the most sensible option to take. But again, this is still not without any risk. But a pro rata bonus is actually what we use for individuals if they're on maternity leave. And it was determined that it's not discriminatory to pro rata a bonus entitlement, which is measured by the individual's performance, to exclude absence whilst the individual is on maternity leave. And this does exclude the period of compulsory maternity leave, which is 2 weeks if you work in an office environment and 4 weeks if you're in a factory. So you would use that period for calculating your bonus, and then you would remove the remainder of the ordinary and additional maternity leave. So if we are looking to pro rata a bonus, you've still got a number of questions that you do need to consider. So, for example, how are we going to pro rata it? If you think about this year, we've got 252 working days, given that we have an additional day for the Jubilee Bank holiday, which is where the Cliff Richard question came up at the start. So are you going to pro rata the bonus from day one of absence, or are you going to do it after a certain period of time, so a trigger date, so to speak? And that needs to be a business decision for your environment. So you might give, for example, a leeway of 5 days, you might give a leeway of 10. But then you have to be mindful that people might abuse that potentially free period to obtain a bonus. But then it could cover people who you don't want in the office, who might have a stomach bug, for example. You also have to think about what you will do with individuals who could qualify as disabled under the Equality Act. And again, that is a test that you should run alongside your HR department or an employment solicitor. And it was an important factor that was addressed in the case actually involving the Land Registry back in 2013. So in this case, the Land Registry operated a discretionary bonus scheme, and under the terms of the scheme, an employee who received a formal warning for sickness during the relevant year was ineligible to receive a bonus. So we have an individual called Miss Horton, and she brought a claim alongside four of her colleagues. They were all disabled and had had a number of disability-related sickness absences, which had led to all five of these employees being given a warning under the sickness absence policy. And in turn, they were not eligible to receive the bonus. What the Employment Appeals Tribunal found was that there was a clear link between each employee's disability and the non-payment of the bonus. The tribunal has held that the bonus scheme was discriminatory and could not be justified. So that's something to bear in mind. So the most sensible approach when you pro rata is to perhaps have your trigger date at 5 to 10 days, but then remove any disability related sickness absence. And again, it's personal choice, it's business decision, and you could exercise your discretion for certain individuals. So if you have an individual, for example, who is going under chemotherapy and is having sickness absences for that, but is still attending work, for example, you could use your discretion there. So what I would recommend is to review your existing bonus scheme wording and have a look at the terminology that you use. Is it a contractual bonus? So is the employee generally entitled to it, full stop? Or is it discretionary? And if it is discretionary, what payments have you made over the last 5 years? Have these been varied? Have you ever not awarded a bonus? Because if you haven't, this would more likely be the exercise of a discretion. The other thing is, if you haven't got a bonus policy and you issue a bonus, you should make clear what your terms and conditions are. So for example, is your bonus to encourage loyalty or is it to reward performance? Are there any elements which you would determine to be discretionary? You would set out that there may be a nil bonus in a year if certain circumstances permit that. The fact that there might be factors that are taken into account when you're exercising your discretion, that the receipt of a bonus in 1 year doesn't create an automatic entitlement in future years, and that the scheme may be amended or withdrawn without compensation at any time. It's also key to outline your arrangements if somebody has given notice to the business and what happens after they've left. So ideally, you want to say there's no bonus entitlement if the individual is under a period of notice and or have left employment. So what can you conclude from this? Well, it probably raises more questions than answers, unfortunately, and there's not really a right or wrong way to approach the relationship between a discretionary bonus and sickness absence. You can withhold your bonus, but you do need to be mindful of those individuals who could qualify as disabled, and those who are on long-term sickness absence may well fall into the definition that's set out in Section 6 of the Equality Act. So I would look at your pro rata bonus, check your trigger date, look at how you will discount disability-related sickness absence, and then assess your criteria on a business level. There are a lot of nuances to this question, so if you do have a more specific scenario we'd like to run through, our contact details will be on the slides at the end. Feel free to drop either Keith or I a call. I'll pass you over to Keith for the second question.
Thanks, Ange. By the way, everyone, we were talking about Cliff Richard in the context of the Jubilee celebrations. Ange is right. But the genesis of it was Ange was saying she's more looking forward to viewing Cliff Richard on the TV than she is the Queen. But anyway, I'll let you all digest that as you may. Before getting to the question, we were going to talk about COVID because it's still around. However, we've decided that we're sick of it. So like your snotty hanky that you meant to wrap up and chuck in the bin, we're chucking that in the bin for this week. There is only one thing to say. The revised guidance from the government came out on the 1st of April, which the only major change you need to be aware of is that COVID fell off the list of specific items you need to risk assess. It just goes into the amorphous blob of generalized risks now that you need to be aware of and take into account in your risk assessments within your business. Anyway, dealing with my next question, do I need to offer a self-employed role to an individual who is at risk of redundancy? The short answer, and I can deal with this very perfunctory, is no. So thanks very much. That's me done. I'll pass back to Ange. No, I'm only joking. I'm looking at David panicking at that point. The short answer is no, but actually you'll be surprised how often this question comes up in the context of redundancy exercise. So if we start with the legal context, and I'll explain why I would say no. This is dealt with by section 138(1) or subsection 1 of the Employment Rights Act, if you're that much of a geek you want to read it, which effectively has two aspects. Okay, it says that if an employee accepts an offer of suitable alternative employment in a redundancy exercise, they are not redundant, subject to a 4-week statutory trial period. And consequently, they move across into the alternative role and they get on with things. Okay, they are therefore not entitled to a redundancy payment. However, if they reject an offer of suitable alternative employment, either during, at the start, or at the end of a 4-week statutory trial period, or they just dismiss it outright at the start, they potentially forfeit the right to a redundancy payment if they unreasonably refuse an offer of suitable alternative employment. I have to put my teeth in to get it out there because it's Friday morning and I'm tired. So, what's the context? If you say, well, actually, I've got an offer of a contract on a self-employed basis, would the employee's refusal of that be unreasonable in the context of section 138, subsection 1 of the Employment Rights Act? Well, the short answer is probably no, because section 138 refers to suitable alternative employment, I stress employment, and a self-employed contract is not employment. And so I find it highly unlikely that an offer of self-employment would tick the box to meet the statutory requirement. Looking at it in a bit more detail, what is suitable alternative employment depends on the facts and circumstances of each individual case, and so it will differ from one case to another. But breaking it down a little for you, really important factors in that analysis are pay and things like status. So if you think about pay in the context of an offer of suitable alternative employment and that offer being self-employment, there is no guarantee of work. There is therefore, if you're self-employed, there is no guarantee of income. And consequently, I don't think any tribunal on the planet would probably conclude that somebody therefore refusing an offer of a self-employed contract would be an unreasonable refusal of suitable alternative employment. In addition, status. You go from being an employee who is within an organisation subject to all the rules, accruing employment rights, etc., to somebody who is external to the organisation, somebody who is self-employed and therefore who gets no employment rights, gets no holiday pay, assuming that they are fully self-employed. Consequently, I don't ever see that the statutory test will ever be met. One other word of warning as well, you're going to have to be pretty clear that the person leaving the organisation is moving on to self-employment and are purely self-employment, because I'm sure Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, if they see somebody employed at the end of May and then who suddenly becomes at the start of June a self-employed contractor and their tax status changes, they're going to be asking questions why that person's status is very different and why you're not no longer deducting tax at source. And they're going to crawl all over that. And so consequently, you're going to have to be very clear that somebody's status is that of self-employment if you are going to even consider this. However, two final thoughts for you. The definition of redundancy for the purpose of the Employment Rights Act is where an employer's requirement for employees to carry out work of a particular kind has ceased or diminished, or is expected to cease or diminish. Doesn't matter what the genesis is, if there is a reduction in the need for certain people to carry out certain work, they are going to be legally redundant, and they could be dismissed as redundant, subject to a fair process and things like that. So in that circumstance, if you've got reducing work, there's likely to be a valid redundancy reason. You're likely to be able to dismiss somebody as redundant. So if you then think about the reducing amount of work, you might not have sufficient work to sustain five employees, so you're going to lose two and move to three in a certain position. But there might be some overlap work where you can potentially offer some work to people on a self-employed basis from time to time. Now, what I'd say to you is that's not such a bad thing to consider, because if a claim arises and you have offered somebody a self-employed contract and they do bring a claim, well, there's the duty to mitigate. The employee in that circumstance will have to give credit for earnings earned after their employment ends. And so you are mitigating the impact. You are helping out a former employee as well. In addition, that you can also run arguments that if an employee rejects an offer, they have failed to mitigate their losses. I think that will be quite a difficult argument, particularly if you are saying, well, actually, in this instance, we're losing somebody as an employee, but we can offer them pretty much full-time engagement as a self-employed contractor. But where there is less than a full-time job, there is no reason why you shouldn't consider it. So what I would say is an employee's refusal won't avoid the need to pay statutory redundancy payment in this context, but don't dismiss it, because it does go towards mitigation and softening the blow of the redundancy. But it's not a panacea that will cure all ills if you've cocked up a redundancy exercise. I'm going to pass you back to Ange for the last question.
Thanks, Keith. Just to clarify, I did not say I was looking forward to seeing Cliff Richard over our Queen on the television. When Keith comes back to his desk, we'll be having words. So the final question was whether or not you can minimise harassment in the workplace. Now, this is such a wide-reaching question. I understand it actually arose from comments made about sexual harassment in Westminster this week, which some of you may or may not be aware of. For those of you who don't know, there was an anonymous Welsh MP who alleged that a member of the Shadow Cabinet made comments about her being a secret weapon because women wanted to be a friend and men wanted to sleep with her. So they classed her as a vote winner. And you may have also seen Ruth Jones on the BBC say, and she was quoted as saying, so I'm just going to read this. Sometimes I do not notice harassment or someone saying something demeaning or degrading because I'm so used to it. And that is a problem in and of itself. So harassment, what is it? Well, the legal definition in Section 26 of the Equality Act is that it's unwanted conduct, which in itself is a subjective statement, related to a protected characteristic and has the conduct purpose, has the purpose or effect of violating a person's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating or offensive environment. Now, that is an assessment that's made by an employment tribunal when you get to that situation. And when they take into consideration whether or not the conduct has had that effect, they look at a few things. So they look at whether or not it was reasonable for that conduct to have the effect. And also they look at perception and also the other circumstances that surround the case. So you will hear, for example, we were engaging in banter is something that comes up quite a lot. So avoiding harassment in the workplace, what does it mean in practice? Well, there was an Employment Appeals Tribunal case last year. It was a case of Gellin, and that said that brief and superficial training is unlikely to have a substantial effect in preventing harassment. So as an employer, you can't control what comes out the mouths of your employees, whilst I know some of you may want to do so, but you can put mechanisms in place to try and create a discrimination-free environment. So the first thing that I would advise you to do is to go back to your policies and procedures. So just like with the bonus, there's a lot of reading to have after this Q&A. So look at the policies and procedures, and particularly those dealing with equal opportunities and equality and diversity. Now, these policies should clearly set out your company's clear standards and expectations. And you should also make it clear that any breach of these policies will be dealt with under your disciplinary policy and procedure, which again should be up to date. Now, the case law tells us that it's not enough that you've got a policy in place. You also need to communicate the content of the policy and also inform staff how and where to access your policies. Are they on an intranet? Is it a hard copy in the manager's office? You know, do you have policies just floating around somewhere? if you don't have them in a set place, it might be worth considering doing that. And again, sending an email or communicating to your staff as to where they are. Because the one thing that we do notice quite a lot is when an employer comes to the employment tribunal, they say, oh, hang on a second, we've got an equality and diversity policy. We couldn't have done anything else. And then the employee says, oh, I had no idea this existed. So the communication really is key. The next thing to do is to undertake training and also make sure this is regular and meaningful. So some companies choose to send senior management on training and then disseminate the information of that to their teams. Some will do computer-based learning with a quiz at the end, and others have in-house trainers. There's almost 1,000 people on this call, and we have a wide range of industries here, so there isn't a one-size-fits-all. There's no right or wrong way, and you have to do what's right for your organisation. But the key is that you need to get the ethos and the message across and also relate it back to your industry as well. Finally, you should also make sure that when issues are raised, they're dealt with swiftly and seriously. So if somebody raises something with you informally, you should then look back and say, actually, do we have a more endemic problem in our workplace? You know, is there, for example, horseplay or behaviours which are unacceptable? You need to nip them in the bud before it becomes a serious problem. Sometimes people do think they're having banter, you know, they think they're having a chat, they think nothing's wrong. But there was a case involving race discrimination last year at a Porsche garage where, you know, an individual was engaging in backwards and forwards banter, which was inappropriate, and the judgment had some key comments in there. And one of the individuals who was accused said, hang on a second, I thought he was my buddy and we were having some banter. And this guy come around and said, you know what, I felt I had to engage in it to adopt the culture of the workplace. And actually, I felt discriminated and harassed. And he was successful in his claim. So you have to be mindful about the environment you create and allow to persist in creating as well. So training, policies, communication. And the other reason why this is so important for you as a company is that if you do end up on the wrong side of a discrimination claim in the employment tribunal, you can also plead what we call the statutory defence. And that is a claim that you can bring in response to harassment and other levels of discrimination as well. And in short, that's a defence that as an employer, you've done everything you can and taken all permissible steps to avoid the action of your employee. And what happens is if you are successful, then you will not be held what we call vicariously liable for the action of your employee. So it's very important that you take all steps to make a safe, zero tolerance type workplace to the inappropriate behaviours to protect your staff, but also to draw the line and allow employees to know what is and is not acceptable. So in short, you can't really stop harassment, but you can take steps to minimise and protect the company. Okay, that's the end of my bit, so I'll pass you back on to David. Thank you.
David, I'm probably off camera, but before I just to add something to Andrew's statement, a lot of the time we see people that said it was the point that Angela raised about informal. Okay, we see a lot of people that say employee came along, wanted dealing with informally. So we had a chat and we pushed it to one side effectively. I don't think that's, and Ange didn't say this, I'm just overlaying what she said. I think that is insufficient. There's somebody coming along and saying, I want this dealt with informally. Yes, you have to be mindful about what the individual has said and deal with it sympathetically. However, there's no such thing as an informal problem or something being resolved in that manner. If there's a more endemic problem and somebody says, well, actually, I don't want this blown out of proportion, you've still got to look at it, because if it happens again and you've done nothing, whilst you might have treated it sympathetically, you've still got to look at the root causes and try and deal with them and manage them as Angela set out. OK, sorry about that, David. I just thought I'd jump in and emphasise that last point. Over to you.
No problem at all. Thanks to both of you. Just very quickly for me, just to conclude, we are continuing to work hard to produce and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. This includes all episodes of these Q&A sessions, and there is just a whole wealth of content and updates from the employment team, so please do check them out. And you can also follow the employment team on Twitter at Sintons HR. I put our speakers' details on the screen there in front of you. If there's anything you'd like to discuss, please don't hesitate to get in touch with them or a member of the team. Our next session will be with you Friday, the 27th of May at 10 a.m. And as usual, I'll send the link round nearer the time. Thank you once again for everybody that's tuned in. As Ange quite rightly said, we've got over 1,000 people online today, so we generally don't take that for granted. Thank you once again for listening. We're all off now to jump on a flight to Portugal to spend the long weekend with 81-year-old Cliff Richard, and we'll speak to you next time. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.